It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's no secret that Wisconsin is known for key agricultural industries like dairy, cranberries, and food processing.
But according to a new analysis, Wisconsin's agriculture sectors are vast and diverse, and there are big connections within the farming and food processing worlds.
The five-year analysis known as Contribution of Agriculture to the Wisconsin Economy digs into the revenue agriculture generates, the number of people it employs, and its environmental impact.
It comes out today. The authors join us now. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having us.
And Jeff Hadachek is an Assistant Professor and Extension Specialist in Agriculture and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Jeff, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Steve, big report. People are going to be citing this thing for the next 5 years till the next one comes out. People picture agriculture, they picture maybe a dairy farm. This is a lot more than that. What all is encompassed in this report?
This is something that we do every 5 years to kind of give a kind of a check-in, if you will, to see what's happening to the ag economy in Wisconsin. And what we're seeing is that this particular go-around is that the actual volume of sales has actually gone up a little bit. So in that regard, the economic impact has gone up. But in terms of employment and income that's associated with employment, has actually ticked down a little bit.
And Jeff, food processing is part of this. It's not just on the farm, but that next step in our food chain. And that's a big deal. That's a big part of our agricultural economy in Wisconsin. Talk about that a little.
Yeah. So we take a pretty holistic picture of what we consider agriculture. And that includes everything from the raw production of the product on farm to all the way to the delivering it to the consumer. And yeah, on-farm activity is about $30 billion of industrial revenue, and food processing is like $107 billion. So when we consider what is Wisconsin agriculture, a big chunk of that includes off-farm value-added production of food products.
And Steve, when you look at the overall numbers of people employed in agriculture and food processing, where are people working? I think the bulk of the labor is in that food processing sector, right?
That's correct. It is in food processing. When you think about dairy, for example, 95% of all the milk that's produced actually goes into value-added cheese production. The other thing is that when we think about agriculture, including food processing, a lot of that is actually located in our urban cities. So when we think about agriculture, it's not just a rural industry. It's woven into the fabric throughout the state's economy.
Jeff, what are the trends in that on-farm employment in particular? Take away that food processing in the city. There are people working on the physical farms. What are we seeing over time?
Yeah, it's certainly decreasing. And I think this is one of the things that maybe is a concern, and it hasn't been a trend for the last few decades, is that it requires fewer people to work on farm and to produce the same amount of food. So a lot of that we can attribute to technological production, right? So we have, on dairies, we have automatic milking systems that don't require as many individuals on the farm. So we see production really relatively stable, but on-farm employment is decreasing.
And Steve, we've talked again and again about the number of farms. I hear dairy in particular, I think, going down. I'm doing a motion on my chart to go down here. Production stable or going up. That implies, again, concentration of the industry. Is that something this new five-year report is reinforcing?
That's what we're seeing. We're seeing kind of the aging of the farmers. A lot of farmers are hitting retirement age. They're starting to step out. The next generation does not want to take on the farm. So we see the number of farms declining, but the land that's in production, the number of animals that's in production has stayed the same and indeed is actually increasing a little bit.
Something that's interesting in the report is you guys do something called, I think, a cluster analysis. So when we think of an economic cluster, people might think about Silicon Valley, right, in California, all these tech businesses together, and that does something. The motor industry, the auto industry in Detroit in the 50s and 60s. What kind of clusters, Jeff, are we seeing in Wisconsin that might be opportunities for future growth?
Yeah, right. And so this analysis really sort of pairs together both that on-farm and off-farm contribution to agriculture. So it asks sort of what is Wisconsin's strengths in production? And probably unsurprisingly, dairy is an economic cluster. We have what we call a location quotient of about 10.3, meaning it is relative advantage.
Right. So one is kind of like average, if I read your report. So 10 is a lot.
Yeah. So one is like average production of all of the U.S. states where if you were to have milk production. And so 10.3 is absolutely huge. It means maybe we're relatively about 10 times more efficient producers in Wisconsin than we are in other states of dairy. So that's unsurprising, right? Wisconsin is the dairy state, and we would expect those things. And so what we say that from that analysis is that there's real opportunity for sort of symbiotic relationships between buyers of those products and the sellers. And so in thinking about agriculture as a more holistic framework from farm to fork, there's opportunity to make that supply chain more efficient and work together and grow.
I think that working together is really important. When I first came into Wisconsin 30 years ago, the dairy industry was not functioning as what we would call a cluster. You kind of had the farmers and the processors kind of ganging up on each other a little bit. Today, they kind of realize they're in the same boat. They have to work together to be more efficient and profitable. They kind of transition from just a group of businesses to an actual viable economic cluster.
That may be particularly true when we think about the concentration, because if we have fewer farms that are producing the same amount of milk, those the processors have to work together with those fewer farms to make sure that production remains viable.
We're talking to Jeff Hatechek and Steve Deller. They are the authors of A Big Report, the big five-year report on the impact of agriculture in Wisconsin's economy. Steve, we're talking about dairy, understandable, big deal in Wisconsin. But dairy is not the only game in town. What are some of the other key sectors you have your eye on for good or ill in this report?
Well, that's one of the things that's always impressed me about Wisconsin agriculture is that it is extremely diversified. We're one of the largest cranberry producers in the U.S. We're one of the biggest snap pea producers, vegetable producers in the U.S. It is extremely diversified. When we do our cluster analysis, the one that always pops out is, let me get the name of it here, fur-bearing animals and rabbit production.
Which people don't think of in Wisconsin.
They don't think of that in Wisconsin, but we dominate that industry. So if you buy a coat and it has a fur lining, like a rabbit collar, odds are that was grown in Wisconsin. Overall, compared to dairy, compared to cranberries, it's pretty small. But our agriculture is extremely diversified.
And Jeff, you point toward this as an advantage for Wisconsin. If we were all pigs and corn, to pick one of our neighboring states, if the pig economy goes down or the corn economy goes down or there's a blight or whatever, that affects the whole economy. Is that a good sign of resilience, that diversity?
Yeah, it certainly could be a measure of resilience. Like, it's a diversified portfolio when we look at the industry as a whole. And so in recent years and in this year in particular, corn prices are pretty low. Our commodity prices are pretty low. And so I think what that means is that we would have a more buffer relative to some of our neighboring states when it comes to net farm income. And I think that was particularly true historically, too, if we look at sort of the 1980s. Wisconsin was less hurt by the farm crisis in the 80s than some of the other states in the Corn Belt here. Yeah.
It also gives individual farmers opportunities to diversify within themselves. For example, if you're a farmer in the state that's south of us, you're basically corn and beans. There's no other infrastructure to support other crops. In Wisconsin, you could go into hops production if you wanted to, because there's a market for that.
Policy-wise, are there things people can take out of the out of this report and other work the two of you do and say, yeah, we want to support that resilient, diverse farm economy in Wisconsin? Steve, let's go to you on that.
One of the things that's happening is that we're seeing kind of a hollowing out in the distribution of farms. We're seeing growth in the very large farms, which gets a lot of attention. We're also seeing growth in the smaller farms. That's kind of related to local foods. It's related to the diversified agricultural sector. So I think one thing that we could do is look at kind of and celebrate the diversity of our agriculture. And also, I think the other issue that is kind of the elephant in the room is labor shortages. A lot of farmers are adopting these like robotic milking technologies, not because they're fans of Star Wars, but because there's a labor shortage. They don't have a choice. They have to adopt these technologies.
And Jeff, I don't want to dig too far into politics. Immigrants are part of the labor pool that is there. A talk of deporting many of them, cutting back even on legal forms of immigration. Do you see concerns that that labor shortage could be more of a problem in the coming years?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, we're still sort of learning in these few weeks of what, the ag economy and what sort of this new, the new Trump administration, both the Republican controlled Senate and House mean for the farm bill, mean for, acts like the Inflation Reduction Act that was a pretty big policy for agriculture in the last few years. So it's sort of the Wild West. I really don't know. I mean, what's going to happen in the next 4 years? I mean, and it depends on if, programs to deliver on the promises of their campaigns. And so, yeah, I think it would certainly be there's certainly things to watch in labor and in trade for the economy. And if those things were to be delivered, I think there were going to be some pretty major adjustments that will have to take place on farm, which may represent increased costs.
Steve, in our last half a minute, this report goes through 2022, just because of how data goes. What do you have your eye on in that time period since the end of that report?
One of the things coming out of COVID is that farm income was actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. Part of that was government payments. But the most recent 2 years, estimates from the USDA has shown that those numbers have come down. So the kind of the good post-COVID years that farmers had, they're actually down and are not doing very well. So I think if we redid these numbers right now with the current farm income, the impacts would be a little bit lower.
We'll leave it there. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Been talking to Steve Dollar and Jeff Hadacek. They are with UW-Madison School of Agriculture and Applied Economics. They're the co-authors of the new 5-year report, Contribution of Agriculture to the Wisconsin Economy.
Up on Wisconsin Today, independent book publishers in our state are small but mighty in lifting up local authors.
We switched our model a little bit and we really are focusing just on Wisconsin authors and Wisconsin books.
Meet publishers in Mineral Point and Stevens Point on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A handful of companies are known as the Big Five Publishers.
Macmillan, HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, Hachette, and Simon & Schuster. Together, they make up the vast majority of best-selling books in the U.S.
But according to Publishers Weekly, there is a serious industry competitor.
Increasingly, authors are seeking out small independent publishers to take their work from manuscript to the shelf.
In Wisconsin, each year, dozens of books come from independent publishers that work to lift up Midwestern voices.
We dive into their work and the industry with Kristen Mitchell, the owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. Kristen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Ross Tangadal is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. Ross, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Ross, how are independent publishers different from the large commercial publishers or the Big Five?
Well, I can speak obviously from my own experience, but I feel like a lot of small presses operate under a similar set of guidelines or expectations. For instance, a lot of our titles are not agent represented or agent submitted. So a lot of our acquisitions are coming directly from, would-be authors. And so right away, there's this connection between the publisher, the acquiring team, and the author, him or herself, as opposed to sometimes with agents, it's like there's a middle person and it's hard to find that initial relationship with the writer. So I think right away, that's a major difference for our team anyway, is that direct communication and relationship with authors.
Kristen, you found that the term independent publisher is difficult to define. Why is that?
I think because the transition or the growth of the publishing world has changed so dramatically in the last 10 years. For the longest time, it really was mainly the big publishers that has now been whittled down to five. And I think people were finding less opportunity with the big five or the big six or whatever it was at any given time. So I think then people started to look for other resources. Well, why can't we just do this ourselves? Why? So then that self-publishing model started to grow. And then trying to find a balance between the two of them, I think that's where the divergence, that's kind of where the independent publishing generally the model started and came from, is like, well, we can do all the services of a traditional publisher, but we're not going to buy the manuscript and we're not going to pay out advances, but we're going to, similar to what Ross said, work so closely with the author. So I think it's, you know, but independent publishers is a little bit of a broad term, I feel, because everybody's doing it maybe just a little bit different. The university presses are going to act a little bit different than my press, and my press is going to act a little bit differently than somebody who might be a very niche publisher. So I think that's why I think it's a little bit of a hard term to define.
Ross, Cornerstone being among just a handful of student-staffed presses in the country, how are students involved in the publishing process at Cornerstone?
They're involved in every department. So a traditional publishing house has editorial, production, marketing, sales, you name it. And students, as staff members of the press, while taking publishing classes, get to take a role that they want. So if they want to design book covers, they get to work for the production team. If they want to learn how to be editors, in order to become an editor, you actually have to edit things. And so they get a chance to edit manuscripts with our editorial team. If we have students that are really savvy with social media and are more marketing centric in their studies, hey, we've got a media team that needs to have materials made and connections made with authors. So honestly, when we say student staff press, we mean it. It's students involved in every facet of the publishing process.
And Cornerstone recently marking 40 years, how has interest in publishing changed over time? What have you seen?
There are so many writers in the United States, especially. And there's not always the opportunity for those writers to become published authors. And so certainly from what I've seen in my short 8 years here is that our number of submissions has just skyrocketed. There are so many people that have stories to tell, that have narratives that they've been working on, that maybe they've been publishing stories and poems in magazines and they want to try to make a book out of things. It's been so great to see the quality of submissions continue to improve year in and year out, because there are so many great writers out there that just haven't been given that opportunity yet.
That's exciting and hard all at once. Kristen, I would imagine you get lots of manuscript submissions each year. What goes into accepting one or denying one?
We do get a lot of submissions a year, and we, earlier in the year, in this year, we switched our model a little bit, and we really are focusing just on Wisconsin authors and Wisconsin books. Mm-hmm. I honestly thought that maybe our submissions would dwindle a little bit because I was really kind of pulling in the focus, but it had the opposite effect, and we're getting, and to Ross's point, there are so many fantastic writers out there. When we get a submission, there's a team of us similar to Ross's team, and we all take a look at it. So the editor's going to look at it and do an editorial assessment. Is this book, does it align with what kind of books we want to publish? Is it a well-written book? And then really at its core, how much or how little work needs to be done to make it a really great published book? PR and marketing steps in. Okay, is there a niche for this book? Is there going to be a built-in market? And if there's not, you know, and we still want to take it on, how do we pivot and make that work for the author? And then I kind of feel like my role is basically project management person, managing expectations person, is really just to kind of vet the author. I really want to get to know them. I want to know what their aspirations and their goals are. So I really, because we build relationships with these people, and we have to, the idea is that we have this great working relationship. So ultimately, the author gets exactly what they need. And to get to that end goal, we have to make sure that we all, my whole team, feels that this is the book that, you know, we really want to champion and put out into the world, and the author we want to work with.
If the author is flexible about their craft versus pretty rigid about what they've submitted, how do you interpret that?
Well, that's a good question, because it does happen where, you know, we can see opportunity for growth within a manuscript. And if we, and I'm always willing and happy to make the suggestions, I always ask first if they would like the feedback. And if they do want the feedback, if they're too rigid and really feel that their book is the best that it can be as it stands, then it's most likely not an author we're going to work with.
Ross, the publishing and editing process, as you know, can be tough. It can be subjective. There is feedback, as Kristen mentioned. How do you work with students on this aspect of publishing?
Absolutely. So again, what's really a unique part of our operations that we have undergraduate students working within the departments of the press. And so the way that my courses are set up is we have several days where we're only focusing on press-related materials. So the feedback that students receive, say, through the editorial department is really being given to them by our editorial director, who we recently hired. He was an undergrad for me for 2 years. And then now we created a position so that we could hire out an editorial director to assist with our really, really impressive growing list. And so now he, Brett Hill, will be in charge of training and orienting our new editorial assistants. And so the feedback really comes from trust. I, since the day I got here, trust that my students are adults and I will treat them that way. And therefore, much is expected of them. And every single time that I've done that, the students rise to the occasion. You have to give them the opportunity to both fail and succeed, but every single time they succeed, in my estimation. So that's really how we build not only relationships with authors, but how I then build relationships with these students who are learning the trade.
We're talking about independent and small publishers in Wisconsin with two industry leaders. That is Ross Tangadal, who is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. We have Kristen Mitchell with us, the owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. Kristen, some indie publishers in the state specialize in niche genres, topics like nautical books or medical physics, or there's Shields Publications in Eagle River specializing in earthworm publishing. How do these niche publishers fit into the publishing world?
So I think sometimes they're born out of necessity or serving that need. Many, and I'm being very broad in this, but I think that a lot of times, oftentimes, those publishing companies are started very specifically to fill that niche, that need. Oftentimes, it's an author-run publishing company. I know of several publishing companies that were started because the author couldn't find a publisher that they could align with and decided to start their own imprint so that they could publish their own books. And then I think they build on that, right? They've built a niche, and then other people that may fall into that specific category can come to them and then also be published. So, I mean, we're all valuable. There's value in all of our models.
Ross, at Cornerstone Press, working to elevate that Midwestern voice, the Wisconsin authors, how might stories from Midwesterners differ from stories that you would get from the coast?
Sure. So, you know, we hate to be stereotypical of either the coast or the Midwest, but we consider the Midwest, you know, flyover country, the heartland, all of these kind of stereotypes of what the Midwest is. It's a simple place. It's not a place of vibrancy or culture. And of course, we all know that to be false, right? Especially those of us that live in the Midwest. And so I feel, and I grew up in the West. I'm from Montana, yet I've been a Midwestern transplant now for over a decade. And I very much associate with being a Midwesterner, because the stories that are told by people from this region have just as much vibrancy, culture, and intentionality as those from New York City or from Los Angeles. And so Midwestern voices need a space where they can be elevated. And if the independent book industry can be part of that space, that's wonderful. We need to elevate more voices, not exclude more voices.
Okay, so we've gotten to the point here, Kristen, where you can elevate a voice. Can you give us an example of a memorable book published through your press?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is the Dane County Farmers Market Cookbook. Huh. Commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Dane County Farmers Market. So that's the kind of the epitome of what kind of elevation we're talking about with Midwestern voices. Therese Allen authored the book, worked closely with the Farmers Market board. And that has been one of our best-selling books. We're on our second run. We do traditional print runs and we do print on demand. And it's been our, we're on our second run of 5,000 books within, we released it in July of 2023. So, it's the opportunity to, on a global scale, share what Dane County and Wisconsin has to offer in that food scape, so to speak.
That must make you feel really good, because for each manuscript, you really have to think through the future and what could happen if it is published, like the financials and the numbers, and you have to run all of that alongside a compelling manuscript. What is that like for you?
Well, I find it to be extraordinarily fun because a lot of our job is to like see the potential, think long term, see the potential, just not now, but what is this going to do for our author, their platform, their life now, but in the future? Is this the first book in a series? Is this their trial at really putting out their shingle as an author? Who are they going to touch? For how long are they going to touch people? How are these books and words going to affect? How many people are going to cook these recipes?
Ross, can you give us an example of a memorable book published through Cornerstone?
This is like trying to pick your favorite child. Honestly, we work with so many books now. When I took over the position in 2016, we were publishing one book a year. So I would have a very easy answer there, because one book a year only makes for so many total books over time. But we've since expanded to, 20, 30, 40 books a year over the last several years. So with all of our genres and all of our authors from various states, I'm honestly proud of all of them. But for a few, the Wisconsin poet laureate Margaret Rozga, we've published two of her books, her collected poems, Holding Myself Together, here a couple of years ago, and then her most recent collection, Restoring Prairie. So proud to be associated with not only Margaret as a poet, who's just a wonderful Wisconsin poet, but also the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission. That's been a really wonderful relationship. And then in terms of stories, I do have a soft spot for my Wisconsin writers, my Wisconsin short story writers. Kim Suhr is putting out her second collection with us, Close Call, here in a month. And her short story collection, Nothing to Lose, was one of our best sellers when it came out a few years ago. So, but I could sit and tell you so many stories of every individual author, every individual book that we've worked on since 2016. So it's been a wonderful ride thus far.
May I ask how you have been able to scale up in such a way?
Sure. So one, we've expanded the amount of classes that we offer for publishing students. So instead of having one class per year, we have one every semester. They're all filled with 20 to 23 students. So that right there expands your staff considerably. I've also just created more of a space where we can see authors in different networks. And so instead of trying to do all of our work and all of our sales right here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, we're getting authors from Ohio, from California, from New York, from Indiana, because each network for each author yields significant benefits, whether it's sales or prestige or reviews. And so just slowly but surely now into a larger operation, we have the staff for it. We have the bandwidth for it, the support from our university, which has been considerable. And now, of course, the different networks of writers that we work with.
I do want to ask about AI before we go here. The AI publishing website says it has a place for authors to help build books to boost sales, full manuscripts, proofreading, personalizing writing, brainstorming book ideas. Kristen, you first, how do you think about AI incorporating into the publishing world?
I was very wary, but I have recently been using AI. So I'm a graphic designer by trade. It's I've been doing it for over 30 years. And I have seen the opportunity with AI for cover designs. So a whole new world has opened up to me as a designer of some fantastic book covers. So I can see the advantage of using it in that way. I am a little wary still. I don't know how. I understand the capabilities of AI peripherally, but I don't know how it's going to translate to the written word. I honestly don't have a good answer for that, because I'm skeptical. And I think it's going to get harder and harder to discern AI versus not AI. And we use Ingram for distribution. I've even noticed now when I'm uploading a book file, That's one of most of my platforms now have that question. Was AI used in any form of creation of this book?
Wow.
Mm. So I think that is telling that we're just kind of on the beginning of who knows what's coming, but we're already starting to see adaptations to weed out whether or not it was created in AI.
Ross, your thoughts?
I've always told students that the greatest invention in human history was the book. The very idea that we can catalog human striving and human emotion and story and narrative through this physical object that is labored over not only by a writer who writes, but by compositors, typesetters, book designers, marketers, booksellers. Writing is the essential act of the human. And I think that though AI is becoming part of our regular lives, and there's ways in which, of course, you should utilize technology to your benefit. John Berryman, the poet, he said that we flash and yearn as humans. Humans flash and yearn. And I would rather see the flashing and yearning of a writer struggling to write and then creating something out of their flashing and yearning than just seeing something that's been spit out by a machine that has no heart and has no brain. So we are very much about telling human stories by humans for humans.
Ross and Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Kristen Mitchell is owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. And Ross Tangadal is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point.
Coming up, a new documentary shares the early days of punk rock in Green Bay and the community that brought together bands and their fans.
They were sort of misfits, didn't quite fit in, and just found this like collective spirit.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about the power of preparing a good meal.
Writer Crystal Chan loves to cook. During the pandemic, she traveled home often, enjoying long stays with her parents. To show her gratitude, she would cook delicious and comforting dishes for family dinner. She shares a story celebrating the labor of love that goes into making a great pot of stew.
A little while ago, when I was visiting my parents in Wisconsin, I found an old cookbook that I had purchased in France. I've been visiting my parents as an extended guest throughout COVID, journeying back and forth between Oshkosh and Chicago. Gratefully, my parents welcomed my ping-ponging across the state line with open arms. Come, stay as long as you'd like. Leave whenever you wish. I love cooking, and I quickly found that making home-cooked meals for my parents elicited oohs and ahs, and my stepdad's famous understated way of declaring that he loved a dish. He would say, "I could eat that again." Cooking was a very excellent way to express my gratitude. So I took that French cookbook and found a recipe for beef bourguignon. The next day, I made the pot of deep simmering broth, rich chunks of beef and vegetables and wine. My parents exclaimed how I was filling up the whole house with such rich smells. There is something indeed really special about filling up the house with the loving smell of simmering food. I am a foodie for sure, and I have found that it's a very sensual way of taking up all the space in the house. You put love into a pot, add a gentle flame, and then surrender to the process of transformation. And somehow, it fills up the whole house, this energetic field of nourishment and love of which I am a critical part. I love the meditation of cooking. You transform one thing into another. You take multiple ingredients and somehow they turn into a unity that perhaps an onion and a carrot could not have otherwise imagined. Then, if you are lucky, you can share such love food with beloveds and the deep aromas of stews that will linger in the house long after the meal is over. That's how love works. This resonance gently permeates so that the moment you open the front door, it greets you. Love, savory and nourishing, caressing you all, both unseen and everywhere. After hours of simmering, I declared that the meal was ready. My stepdad had set the table hours before in his wordless display of anticipation, so I poured the glasses of wine, reverently placed the food on the plates, and granted them to my parents with a flourish. To our stunned delight, my stepdad took his time eating. Usually, he inhales his food. Now he savored it, feeling the flavors in his mouth, tasting the thyme and the deep love it rested upon. My mom excitedly asked me questions about the recipe, the process. I told her what I could about the recipe, but the process? That's harder because it includes unnameable steps. Feeling into the timing of the food, knowing the exact moment the next step needs to begin, and infusing the recipe with love. Finally, as we sat back in our chairs, hands on our contented stomachs, my stepdad looked at me with sparkling eyes and said in his ritual exclamation, "I could eat that again."
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the power of preparing a good meal. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
It's Wisconsin Today.
That's The Tyrants playing the song Attitude. The Green Bay punk rock band helped launch a thriving punk music scene in northeastern Wisconsin.
Members of The Tyrants and other punk bands are featured in a new documentary called Green Blah. It follows the story of punk rock in Green Bay from the late 70s through the 80s.
Chris Preddy was there as a member of the band A Bunch of Morons and as a creator and director of Green Blah. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into the documentary, this is a personal story for you. You were part of this scene. You were in a band, A Bunch of Morons. What is it as a young guy in Green Bay that drew you into the punk rock scene?
It came to me from a couple of different sources. I had a really good friend in grade school whose mom worked at WAPL Radio. And she would bring home promo records. And my buddy Chris and I would, you know, sit in the bedroom and just flip through these records and play whatever looked, you know, interesting. And I don't know, we just stumbled across the Ramones, we stumbled across the Clash and Black Flag, and it just sort of drew me in. There's a lot of there's kind of like an outsider aspect to this, and I wasn't really a sports guy. You know, I was kind of I like to read and I like art. I'm not good at art, but I just appreciated that sort of thing, and it was just different and unique, especially, you know, growing up in Green Bay, which is very much Rust Belt, paper mills, factory workers, Green Bay Packers, you know, so it was like a breath of fresh air, I guess.
Well, and that's something that really struck me. I mean, this is partly a documentary about the music, but it's also about people finding their people. How important was that?
Very important. It does come out in the film. There's a couple interviews I can think of where people really felt like they just found others that were willing to accept them. And, you know, right, they were sort of misfits, didn't quite fit in, and just found this like collective spirit. And, You know, you met people from just all over, you know, different parts of the city, even from smaller communities outside of Green Bay. That was the attraction. And it just really formed like a familial type bond. Some of these friends that I met at the first punk show that I went to back in June of 1983, and I'm friends with today.
A point I want to hammer home here for younger listeners is there wasn't an internet when you guys were pulling this scene together, right? Punk music was breaking around the world, and it kind of trickled in weird random ways. Like you said, somebody's mom worked at a radio station and had these demos and whatever. How did people absorb this and pull it all together in this pre-internet age?
An important factor for Green Bay was we had a college radio station. It was WGBW, and it was out of the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And there were DJs that, you know, you could play pretty much whatever to your heart's content. I mean, you brought in your own records or, you know, they had promos there and so forth. But that was one source of getting information. I would go down to, there was a place called Boss's. It was Boss's bookstore. And they had like a slew of different magazines and stuff from all over. So like Cream Magazine was a big one. You know, you could page through there and there was punk rock in there. So, you know, he found it where he could. Fanzines were important. There was a particular one in Green Bay called Sick Teen. A friend of ours, Norb Rozek, who I went to high school with, and that's where I first encountered it, was in geometry class. Norb was in a band with this guy, Perry. Perry and I sat in geometry alphabetically. And one day he just noticed that I was into different kind of music, and he handed me this copy of Sick Teen. And I was just like, astonished. I had no idea what to make of it. I'm like, wow, another kid at this high school puts this together.
I want to check out one of the bands from kind of the first wave, as you describe it, of the Green Bay punk scene. And we'll give a listen here. This is a band called The Miners, and this song is Waves Have Hit. So, Chris, the Miners were one of a couple early bands that set the stage, literally, in some ways, for the punk scene in Green Bay. Talk a little bit about the Miners.
They were like the first wave of Green Bay punk rock, and they did shows largely at a place called Bernie's Game Room, which was on the west side across from West High School. And then they played like Night Moves. It was like a teen disco. They played Brown County Fair, but anyway, they were very influenced by, you know, that early like Clash, Sex Pistols, The Damned, that UK sort of thing, Ramones from the US, that sort of stuff. And they were sort of the precursor to the scene that I grew up in, which was kind of later in the 80s. So they were around like 79, 80, 81. And they were from like the west side of Green Bay. They put out a 45, which had two songs on it, which one we just played. And then the other band, The Tyrants, also put out a 45 with two songs. They recorded those records down in Ripon, Wisconsin. And those were really the first two punk records to come out of Green Bay, Wisconsin. So very much trailblazing.
We're talking about a new documentary called Green Blah about Green Bay's early punk scene. Chris Preddy is a co-creator and director of the film. Now, there were some downsides, in large part the reaction the punks in the scene got. Some of the film focuses on the response in Green Bay to people dressing differently, listening to different music. I want to give a listen to one of the scene members describing their experience.
I know why I left. Getting my ass kicked was just... I was done. You know, I got home, cut my rat tail off. This shit is not worth it. It just kind of got out of that scene. But I, at this point in my life, I look back and it really hurts because I don't know why I walked away from those friends, you know?
Can you talk some about that negative response from, you know, people in the community and your age group in particular?
Yeah, that was very real. It's so much different these days because I've made comments amongst people I know today where, you know, you might see somebody with pink hair or green hair and it's like pretty commonplace. But for Green Bay and I mean, Wisconsin, I think in general, and I mean, even bigger cities, Chicago, it's like if you were in 1983 and you were outside the norm, it was not very well received. Sometimes you would get into fights or, and it was really for, I would say, looks that weren't that extreme. You know, I mean, you know, you can always picture punks, like if you think England, you know, Mohawks and whatever. But I mean, in Green Bay, it was short hair and, you know, wearing a pair of Chuck Taylors and riding a skateboard.
Yeah. You looked like a bunch of Wisconsin kids to me.
Yeah, right. It wasn't really. Yeah, I remember I was skateboarding home from my high school and, you know, four kids pulled up in a car and started giving you grief. And it's like, okay, really? I mean, not really that extreme. But yeah, you really did come across that in high school. You know, people would say things or maybe spit on you. But eventually, you know, I mean, like you said, a punk sort of became mainstream later on. And now it's just pretty widely accepted, I would say, overall. But I think in this day and age, people don't sort of realize that it, at the time it was happening, it was, you kind of had to really live with consequences, I guess. You know what I mean?
On a more positive note, something that struck me, of course, the heroes of the documentary are the, you know, the bands and the organizers and the fans and things like that. Lurking at the margins are older people, some of them who would say, yes, yes, you can practice in our basement, even though I don't know what this noise is that you're making. Or, yeah, I have a recording studio. I don't know what you kids are playing, but sure, I'll record you. Kind of inspiring as someone now in an older generation, like saying yes to the kids, even if you don't get what the heck they're doing.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. And one of the venues that we had in Green Bay that's in the latter part of the film is Kutzka's Hall. Yeah. Bob Kutzka, who ran Kutzka's Hall, bar side of the hall, or there was the bar, and then there was the dance hall. And the punk shows would be happening in the dance hall, but then, like, Bob and his regulars would be hanging out in the bar. And, you know, some of the older punk guys would go in there as well. But that was Bob's feeling on it, was, you know, that these kids weren't really accepted elsewhere in the city. And, you know, we were trying to behave. We had these shows, and if they weren't as terrible as everybody would expect. And, you know, we had a lot of respect for Bob for, you know, having that openness and the willingness to have those shows there. And we had shows there for, I mean, like 4 or 5 years.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
That's Chris Preddy, co-creator of Green Blah, a new film about Green Bay's early punk scene in the 1970s into the 80s. You can see it at the Tarleton Theater. That's coming up on December 21st. This is more from the city's early punk rock scene. It's the band Depo Provera. The band, the song is called Brainwash. It's a new year, and we have a whole new year of radio programs to produce. And hey, maybe you can help us out with some suggestions.
We want to hear your ideas for topics we can cover in the future and the people we can bring on the show.
Is there an important issue affecting your local community that you want to hear about, or something happening in state government that you want more focus on?
Or is there a cool event in your community or someone who is doing something to make a difference there?
We want your suggestions, and you can share them with us right now or anytime. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call and leave a message or text. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.